Wonderful. Thank you very much. Again, really illuminating, and from the horse's mouth. So these are very very valuable contributions, and we have, thanks to the incredible sort of discipline and focus of our panelists, we actually have time for discussion, which is wonderful. So I'd like to invite your comments, and if there are comments or questions from people online, shall we start with one of our participants from online while you're gathering your thoughts?
We have a wonderful bio from Kathia Flemons, who also asks a question. She says, she's joining us from the office at the National Clearinghouse for English Language Acquisition at GW. And is actively involved with immigrant youth and young adults. She, too, is the firstborn of immigrant parents from Haiti. Her dad was a refugee from Haiti escaping from his life for 40 years ago. Kathia was born here, American, and her parents always remember Mayor Koch of New York, who did a lot for immigrants in New York, which permitted many immigrants in the city to actively get involved with business development in the city and their native land. Her question is, how can diaspora effectively advocate for those needing assistance in the homeland while engaged in either foreign policy or policy advocacy in the U.S.? What would be the best form of exchange? And how can you move quickly on humanitarian efforts when time is of issue?
That's an excellent question, and I would invite any of you to respond to it, and there may be those in the audience who have some comments on that.
Start with the, not on the advocacy side, but more that, you know, most diasporas are already organized, and disasters like the one that the questioner describes, you often also mobilize groups for the first time. So the early responders, the first responders, are those who have already been organized and may already have philanthropic activities on the ground. But then there are these newly mobilized people who may be mobilized to raise money, but they have to have a place to target their money. So the best lesson, I think, here is for the philanthropic sector of diaspora organizations to be well organized and visible to their own constituencies. So that's what I know from the philanthropy side, but perhaps you guys can speak to the advocacy side.
I'll also add to the philanthropy side, only because a lot of the issues I know that a lot of Muslim communities are dealing with, that's been one of the biggest challenges. So I think we're in the same situation. I think not only raising the awareness of the need for the philanthropy, that's part of it. I think for a lot of groups right now, they're also struggling with the legal procedures and processes of giving abroad, especially in the way that we're working. And I think organizations that can actually help communities kind of maneuver through all of that and figure out what are the legal ramifications for giving and how to give and what are you accountable for giving and all of that. I know that that's one of the biggest constraints, but I have not yet seen many organizations within Muslim communities that are having this challenge actually helping them to do that. And so similarly, I think helping people in the Haiti example, helping people kind of walk through step by step. I think there's an assumption of raising the awareness is just enough, but how do you actually help and provide the vehicles to do that is what I think will also help resources mobilize.
Well, let me just add a couple of thoughts there. I think in the context of whether it's a natural or a human-made disaster, there are probably the first critical step is disseminating information about it. I wrote my thesis on the Nigerian Civil War way back in the 70s, where the single most important weapon of Biafra was a fax machine that had an outlet in London, pre-internet, pre-mobile phones, digital cameras and so on. But they put out a steady stream of pictures of starving children, you know, wounded civilians and so on. And it had a tremendous mobilizing effect. I have to say some of it was really quite misleading, but it did have it had the desired effect of mobilizing people. So getting information, and in this day and age where it's very easy to check how accurate the information is, getting accurate, good information out through the news media, through social networks, and to policymakers is the first critical stage. And then I think, as both Jennifer and Nadia mentioned, building coalitions, building alliances. We see on the in diaspora philanthropy that there's often a huge bump. People want to give, not just members of the diaspora, but others too, in the aftermath of a disaster of some kind. But in that sort of rush to give, a lot of resources, frankly, get wasted because the channels for using them effectively have not been set up. So I think members of the diaspora really need to look to experienced organizations to partner with to make sure that the resources they're able to mobilize are being used effectively. And the final step, I think, and our questioner alluded to that in her in sort of introducing in the question, was how you move beyond the sort of philanthropic response to a policy response, and I think that's really important. I think for many people, philanthropy acts as sort of a portal to a broader engagement. You know, people see there's a problem, they want to respond to it, but it doesn't take much engagement if you go beyond that first or second contribution to say, why is this happening? Why is the system so unable to respond to people's needs? What's the problem here? So I think to try to use that energy that gets aroused by something like the earthquake in Haiti, the hurricanes in Haiti, is very important to try to translate that into a broader mobilization that really starts to address some of the policy issues.
Can I just add one more quick thing? Because I was really struck by what you said in your last bullet point about the politics of participation, and it seems to me, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, it just seems that the diasporas that are going to be most effective in policy influence are going to be the ones who are better integrated in all of these different areas. And this can also overcome the challenge that the Muslim community has in terms of philanthropic giving, that a lot of diasporans are organizing their own 501c3s registered in the United States to do philanthropic work. So donating to U.S. organizations bypasses that problem, lends legitimacy and credibility to the advocacy efforts, et cetera. So being, you know, overall more organized, diverse, and integrated.
I 100% agree, and I'll just throw out a little bit of an unusual idea, just as a thought experiment, right? Mm-hmm. Let's just say that the folks who occupy a high percentage of decision-making roles in U.S. government did not have roots, let's say, in Europe, but instead had roots in South America, mm-hmm. or they had roots in Asia or Africa. Would American foreign policy be different? Of course. Of course it would be different. There's no, like, mm-hmm. people bring something to the equation, and if you accept that as true, then I think you could argue that, well, how would it be different if there were more Muslim Americans in government? Well, it would be different, and it would be, I think, more reflective of the American population, because I don't know the numbers, but I'm mm-hmm. guessing the numbers are low. Mm-hmm. And is that the result of hiring practices? I don't think so. Is it? Maybe it is, or is it that people just aren't applying enough? I don't know those answers, but certainly.
Your parents want them to be doctors.
Yeah. very good point. But the experiences that people bring to the table obviously shape their views, and obviously ethnicity in America is people think of ethnicity as, well, if you're recently arrived, your folks recently arrived, or if you think about the old country, that's ethnic. Well, guess what? Someone who's been here 4 generations is also ethnic, or 18 generations. They're still ethnic. And they bring their family's experience and their own values to the table in ways that are equal to the guy who arrived yesterday at the port, right? As long as we're citizens and we're full stakeholders again. So I think, seeing sort of the decision-making process be include sort of a or accurately reflect or more accurately reflect the actual population would probably be a healthy thing.
Yeah, I'd like to get into the issue of mobilization at a later stage if we have time. But first, we have a question. Could you kindly introduce yourself?
My name is Filmona, and I'm with Interaction. I just wanted to say thank you, and to Kathleen, I did read your the chapter.
I'm flattered.
I didn't raise my hand earlier, but it was a good chapter, so thank you. And then my question or comment, I think some of you touched on that some of the ingredients for effective advocacy is that you have to care, you have to understand the issues and really believe in it. But as Aram touched on at the end, a lot of people don't believe that change is possible because, like you said, you stick your neck out and you're likely to get it chopped off. So I think one of the ways around that is maybe doing more collective advocacy with diaspora groups so that, and maybe an example of Syria, instead of just Syrian Americans doing direct advocacy, having other Arab Americans chiming in, because they're not going to face the same direct consequences that you would, if you're directly involved. So I'm just wondering, are there any examples of that kind of collective diaspora advocacy? And does that help people get over the challenges and concerns of being too visible, I guess?
I think that's a comment behind you that may also be relevant, and then we'll come back to the lady next to you.
Hi, I'm Dina Shacker from the State Department, from the Office of Global Partnerships. I think on your seats you might have some of the cards that say IDEA on them. I've seen them around. The Secretary launched the International Diaspora Engagement Alliance last May precisely for that reason, recognizing not only that we need to bring these communities to the table because they are partners in development and diplomacy, but also that there is power in collective action and that these communities have a lot to learn from each other. Even the example here of Nadia and Aram learning from each other. Imagine that on a much larger scale. We had about 550 leaders from global diaspora communities come to the State Department, and I think there were about 30 panels on a variety of different themes, from innovation to entrepreneurship. And at each panel, there were speakers from different communities, and I think that's the only example I've seen, and that many made the same comment, where you had these different communities really who have no competition with each other. It's not the same as if you were to put everyone in the same room, and there is that kind of regionalism, truly learning from each other. And so I think not only that these groups need to collectively within their regions come together, but also to learn laterally across communities. An IDEA was, again, just launched last May. We're in the process now of being incubated at the Migration Policy Institute, and it will graduate to be its own 501c3. But The U.S. government is really beginning to recognize this. This is a huge departure, I think, as we probably all agree from earlier policies. But it's something that I see as being very integral to our foreign policy and development efforts in the coming few years.
Yeah. Great. And if you could pass the mic just ahead. Yeah.
Did you have another question?
I think that was just a comment from Dina.
No. I'm just saying, did you want us to respond to that before you took another question, or did you? I just wanted to respond to that, basically.
Okay, please do, if you'll be patient for a moment.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. So I think there's two things. I think collaboration, without a doubt, will lead to more effective advocacy. And on a domestic level, we're seeing that. One of our closest partners that we ended up working with is Jewish Funds for Justice, and our work, and we were able to both partner in terms of we identified similar needs and have in training, but also what we're finding is there's also common policy issues, whether it's fair banking or and it's interesting in the ability to find partners that you didn't expect to necessarily have and then to be able to mobilize on it. But the other thing I was going to say is I also think one of the most powerful things you said was about the, among the many things, but the one thing that I think really, really affected me is this idea that you have to give people faith that their efforts will have an impact. And I often think that, so going back to what leads to effective advocacy, one of the other things that I think is happening within communities where coalitions may not even help that, but I think before getting to that point, is leadership providing really realistic wins or realistic goals. Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes I think what happens is a lot of leaders set goals that are unattainable, and then people feel disillusioned because they're never winning. And so when you feel like you're never winning, then you feel like the system doesn't work. And so if leaders can set those more realistic goals, then engage in these coalitions, I think they work. But if people keep setting these unrealistic goals and still engage in partnerships, then you're still, there's one step before that one.
I would only add that folks who have a high identity and high devotion but a low capacity, they want to learn typically. And people, in that situation typically learn through two things, example and experience. And that ultimately builds confidence. Confidence, courage, these are like contagious things. They're social phenomena. They're not things that develop on their own. And so the trick is to find in every community the early adopters, the ones who are kind of like a little bit ahead of the curve, and to handhold others through the process. And, you know, the first congressional meeting is scary and the person sits quietly in the corner, and the second one, they ask a question at the end, and the third one, they could run it. You know, that's there's no shortcut to that, but it's courage and confidence are vital. And that happens through experience, example, and a lot of hand-holding.
I'm Olga Bukanga from Interaction as well. And I was hoping you speak about the challenging of diaspora advocacy when the country of settlement favors the government at home and may want to keep the status quo, and also about organizations that are influencing foreign policy for their own good.
Good question. Thank you.
Really good question. There's no definitive answer to that. It goes back to the whole issue of aligning interests. And so that's what I was trying to kind of outline in my presentation overall, is the recognition that diaspora advocacy and advocates can be partners to the U.S. government, but only if there's a good alignment of U.S. government objectives and those diaspora objectives. You have to find that common ground. Of course, this is often a problem when there are major differences between the diaspora interests and the citizens on the ground. And it's an issue that I have raised in every encounter and training that I've done at the U.S. State Department. And I know that most people are aware of this, but I just think it's important to repeat again and again and again that these people in diaspora are U.S. citizens, so they are our constituents from the U.S. government side. They do bring different perspective and information and maybe expertise. All of those things are potentialities. They're not confirmed. But it doesn't make them legitimate spokespeople for people on the ground. And policies always have implications for people in those countries, and we have to make our decisions responsibly in that case. I'm reminded that, you know, there's this other side of diaspora advocacy, and you know, you talking about having the faith and making a difference. In the Coptic Christian diaspora from Egypt, which is a community that I've been studying for a long time, there have been major accusations that the advocacy that the Coptic Christians in the U.S. have done on behalf of Christians in Egypt has actually harmed their quality of life in Egypt and led to more incidents of violence and discrimination. There's not a lot of evidence to support that I'm aware of, but that's an accusation that has an impact on the community's intention to mobilize and advocate. And so I think these questions are more pertinent to the Armenian diaspora than anything I could say in a general sense. So I would really welcome your
views. I'd love to comment on that. Let me give an example that isn't Armenian. We talk about aligning the diaspora, aligning a diaspora, seeking to align itself with U.S. interests. Let's talk about a U.S. interest. For many years, a stated U.S. interest was to support the government in South Africa. South Africa was an apartheid government that had uranium, had gold, had diamonds, controlled a sea lane, and was firmly anti-communist. And as a result, American foreign policy turned a blind eye to the disenfranchisement of millions of South Africans, their torture and torment for decades, people born and raised in that society without any rights, right? And we turned a blind eye to it for geopolitical reasons. Who should align with who in that case? I would have felt no obligation in those years to align myself with U.S. policy. In fact, I would have felt the moral obligation to align myself with the divestment movement and the grassroots movement that challenged that that policy. So the idea of aligning with U.S. policy, it's sort of a nice idea when the U.S. policy is a good policy, but I think there's a higher authority, whether it's moral authority, whether it's faith-based or whatever. I would, in the Armenian instance, say that there are those in the State Department who would argue that recognizing the Armenian genocide is bad for America. I simply cannot imagine a scenario in which recognizing and speaking honestly about genocide is bad for America. It's good for America. That's good for America. So the idea of aligning with interest, no, let's align ourselves with American values and then seek to bring American policy into alignment with the values that we hold, not policy, not the reverse.
Yeah, I think that latter point is really the key one, which is that in a situation like the one you described, that it's got to be a key goal of the diaspora to change U.S. policy. And you know, and I think we've seen that in the Arab Spring. You know, quite a started before that, but you know, a realization that it actually serves U.S. interests better to be aligned with the people than to be aligned with an autocratic regime. You know, that's not a universal conclusion, as you know very well. So it's a, you know, it's a dilemma, but it's part of the task of advocacy, I think. Yes, please.
Metro Koloski with the United Macedonian Diaspora. We're a fairly, I mean, old kind of community, 100 years, but majority of our advocacy has been in the last kind of decade. But early in the 90s, we were very instrumental in the independence movement for Macedonia, and I believe a lot of similar for a lot of the Central and Eastern European countries, especially those that studied political leaders that are elected in these countries were former students in America or exchange students and things like that. One point that I wanted to touch on why people want to become more active, I think, one of the reasons why I think people are becoming more and more active are these kind of visits back to the homeland, I've noticed, like Birthright Israel. For us, I've had numerous members of our organization that would not get active politically, but would on a cultural or other basis, mm-hmm. and then would visit Macedonia for the first time, and then realize what really is the reason why they should get involved, and then they start getting involved more and more. So I think like these types of trips back home, I think, have a great help, but also these student exchanges, alumni. And I can tell you that, you know, once Macedonia elected a government that was primarily educated abroad, they started bringing a lot of people back home to become ministers of government, to attract foreign direct investment, and other ways of engagement. And I have to say, like, majority today are former USAID kind of employees mm-hmm. or contractors that are now the president and prime minister of these countries, which then act as, you know, very pro-American and build those bilateral relations. So those are just some mm-hmm. comments that I wanted to bring to the table. So thank you.
That's a fascinating case study. I'd love to know more about it. But it's one of the groups we worked with in putting together the first Global Diaspora Forum last May was with the American Ireland Funds, and they've done a terrific sort of toolkit, which some of you may have seen on diaspora engagement. Susanna, do you remember their URL?
Diasporamatters.org.
The whole toolkit is online there, and it's from really mainly from the American Ireland Funds that I took away this point of philanthropy often being a portal to broader mobilization. Another point that they would agree with you on very strongly is that diaspora tourism is often a portal to broader engagement. And indeed, we have a chapter in the book on diaspora tourism. So there are lots of routes in, and they're all interesting to MPI and to IDEA. We hope you'll stay tuned at diasporaalliance.org. For those of you who haven't had a chance to read the chapter on diaspora advocacy from this book, if you're interested, it is online both at migrationpolicy.org and at microlinks. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see your hand. Please, we do have one more question, and I think we just about have time for it. So please.
Sorry, the mic's here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, we have two more questions. So if you'll kindly be brief.
Okay. So the question, I don't know if this is brief, but as brief as you can answer. So I'm involved in Shealene International. My name is Azara, and we try to source fair trade shea butter from West Africa. Mm-hmm. And so the question is really more about just, you know, diaspora movements and helping, because I've met a lot of, I'm originally from Nigeria, and I met a lot of people who are doing some kind of side business, many people, and I think this is universal. But there are many different ways in which we do the work that we do. And so for us, we find that we're trying to do a fair trade type of situation, but there's a lot of people who don't necessarily think about those issues. They just kind of want to bring the stuff to market. And there's a lot of sort of economic movements that help a lot of middle-class people in developing countries and not necessarily the poor. So I'm just wondering if you guys have seen any sort of movement with the diaspora working on these kind of issues and really working more with sort of the poor rather than the middle class and just making them richer.
Mm-hmm. So. I'm familiar with the Shea Butter Fair Trade, and it's a great effort. There are some, I know there are fair trade coffee organizations that have been working through the diaspora and so on. I think it's a great entry point, which is not to to denigrate sort of more conventional kinds of entrepreneurship, which I think also plays a part in integrating countries of origin into the global marketplace, often in a good way. But we have a few examples in the book, but I'm very interested in knowing more about more of them, because I do think it's an important kind of people-to-people effort that can really start small and grow. Final question.
Yes, I'm Dmitry Glinsky. I came here to this event, a wonderful event from New York, where I represent the organization called the Russian Speaking Community Council of Manhattan and the Bronx. I have a couple of questions, mostly I think to Nadia and to Aram, who have kind of first-hand experience with their diasporas. One thing is, some of the diasporas are focused on one country, one culture, whereas you have this other broad, gatherings based on religion or language that embrace many, many countries. And obviously, that helps increase the number of the constituency and the voting power. But to what extent there are kind of sort of trade-offs between that and difficulties when you try to build something on a very broad base that really encompasses 80 or more countries, which are in difficult relationships among themselves. And one other question, there are some diasporas where the main role, the leading role is played by people in the second and third generation who are really fully integrated Americans in many ways. There are some diasporas, like, for example, the Russian-speaking diaspora, where almost only people who are really active are the ones who came here in their adult sort mm-hmm. of age. And I wonder whether any of you could reflect a little bit on whether there are any differences in perspective or tensions or collaborations among those different generations of diaspora leaders in your community. Thank you.
Oh, two very interesting questions. I wish we had another 10 minutes to go into them, but we'll have to be very brief. Aram, do you want to?
Typically, you're right that the people who've been here longer tend to have a little more expertise and a little more knowledge and more capacity, and folks who more recently arrived tend to have a little more energy. So it's a question of balancing those interests. I'll speak to the Russian community. I'm familiar with the Russian community. It is true that the most active are the most recently arrived, but that's not to say there's not a very large number of Americans with Russian heritage in America. Just it was very difficult over the course of the last century to kind of articulate that identity because of the geopolitics of U.S.-Russia relations. The same can be said of German Americans. My God, there's so many Americans of German heritage. It's just simply not.
It's the largest ethnic group.
Yeah, but very little German advocacy for reasons that deal with the two world wars, of course, and many other issues. So, that's the Russian community is a special challenge, but also a lot of opportunities. Really?
I'd second. I think there are two really important issues. I think the intergenerational issue is really important. But oftentimes, what you start to see is those communities organizing separately. So you have complete generational divides, where you have the older community kind of coming together, and then the younger, whether American-born community organizing. And what's not happening is that they're not talking to each other. And so in some ways, at least that's what we're seeing a lot, is there needs to be a lot of facilitated conversations between the two, because oftentimes the language they're using is not the same, the references are not the same, so you actually need to facilitate those conversations. And then amongst communities where there's a huge range of diversity, I think what usually happens is there's two dynamics. One is there's a zero-sum game where people are so determined to focus on their issue that they're worried that if they focus on something another issue, then their issue doesn't make it. And so trying to But and that usually happens at a point of crisis, and that's when people wait to build relationships. And you can't build relationships when they're actually there's a moment where you have to make a decision. You have to build the relationships up until that point. And so in a way, there needs to be a space, which is, again, why we set up this institute, is there needs to be a space where you are having those conversations, not focused on that policy decision or that discussion. And in order for people to actually just begin to have a conversation about what's important to each group, and then so that everybody can kind of go on their way and find the points of collaboration. But those spaces are not very common. And finding, most importantly, a neutral convener that can bring those people together. Because oftentimes people are so hesitant to come because there is no neutral convener. And that's what you need to find, is who has street cred within all these communities that can bring those communities to the same table and have these kind of facilitated conversations. Because otherwise, the conversations never happen except when they're negotiating, and then in that case, it's transactional.
That's a very important point. I think there's also often these generational divides arise where you have the first generation, the immigrant generation that has come under pressure, either as a refugee population or political exiles. And who arrive here with a very considerable amount of antipathy toward the government of the country of origin, which may not be foremost in the mind of second and subsequent generations, sometimes because the situation changes in the country of heritage, or sometimes because the attitudes here change. I mean, the Vietnamese diaspora is a very good example of that, where you still have a real diehard first generation that thinks it's just terrible to have anything positive to do with Vietnam, with second and third generations who are really interested in, you know, the emergence of that country and the opportunities there and in discovering their own heritage. So I think Nadia has put her finger on it, that what's really important is trying to set up these intergenerational dialogues, which happens within some diaspora organizations very comfortably, but is by no means the rule. And I'm afraid we have to bring an end to it there. Thank you. It's been a fascinating discussion, and please join me in thanking our wonderful panelists.